Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
The professor speaks.
No, these are not my students. This is our beloved audience. Welcome. I'm Mukulika Banerjee. I'm Professor of Anthropology here at LSE. There is a great sense of excitement that we bring from the green room to the stage. We are all very excited to be doing this hour with you, for you. Thank you for coming. This is an exceptional part of LSE life to have this research festival every year. And it's such a terrific team, evidence of which is today's panel. These are two very different books on the face of it. Let me hold them up. If you haven't seen them, there are copies for sale afterwards and authors will be signing. I promise I didn't match my shirt to the covers of the books. But as I was buying them, somebody said, remarked on this, a student serving me. Very different books because they're located in very different parts of the world. One is Albania, Greece. Leah's book, Michal's book, is in South Asia, before partition, India, Pakistan, and England is very much part of the story. And yet, they are, because I read them both, they are in conversation with each other in extremely interesting ways, and some of them we'll try and draw out today. So let me, instead of asking the authors to tell you what their books are about, which is not the most interesting prompt. I'll try and give them a slightly more interesting prompt. But Michal's book, as she's our guest at LSE, Leah is a colleague, Michal's book, like Leah's, is a deeply personal story of her family and her grandparents and their lives in the first part of the 20th century, how they unfolded, how they met, how they created the families that eventually led to Michal's birth. But really, in telling this very personal family story, there's a backdrop of huge historical upheavals. And that is a story, and you know, we all know Michal Hussein from her political journalism. I'm a huge fan. And the precision and accuracy and the empathy which we have come to associate with her work is there in the book, because I thought, to be perfectly honest, not another partition book. Surely I've learned everything I wanted to. And yet I did. And that's saying something. I'm the only Indian to have lived and worked in Pakistan. I know something about this history. So that historical novel is really what Broken Threads is. Leah's book is set in a very different part of the world. Again, it's about a grandmother. And this one is a story that sees from the beginning of the 20th century huge upheavals in that part of the world, much more directly caught up in the Second World War and the repercussions of that on the lives of everybody who was in Albania at that point. And not just Albanians. It's a very cosmopolitan place. They're Germans, they're British. People are passing through, they're Greeks, and they all, there's a very interesting cast of characters. And again, Leah is an academic philosopher, but writes with real sensitivity and novelistically in this book, which is why I think, quite rightly, she gets a very wide reading audience. So any of you, if you're worried that this is an academic philosopher, I will just pass this one, think again, because it's very accessible. So these are the two books. Now, what brings them together is that both of them are very present in both these books, right? And there is a combination of personal memory and the historical archive and knowledge of history. In Leah's case, she cannot resist the philosophy, but it is wonderfully injected into to help us step back and think about these big events and these lives. So that's as much as I'm going to tell you. If you are dying to find out more, I'm afraid you'll have to buy the book, get it signed if you want. But let me start with a question to each of you, which is about the dedications. Your book, Michelle, is dedicated to your mother, without whom, if you read the book, you can tell why it's dedicated. But tell us, because it's your grandparents' story, and yet the book's dedication is to your mother. And Leah, your book is dedicated to your father, whose mother you are writing about. So tell us a little bit about how you decided to come to make this dedication.
Well, I love the way you brought our stories together, Mukulika, and I will say that when I was asked to this, because obviously I knew about Leah's work and I knew about your work as well, and I suddenly thought, what a great idea to bring us together. But, and I've been to many book festivals, but this kind of grouping has never yet happened. And I will also say we'll draw out many common threads, but one of them is I think there's a moment for both of us where we start thinking more about the past, and for you, it's the fall of communism, and for me, it is deciding I was going to write my family story, but also being at the point in my career where I'd done about, you know, 7-8 years on the Today program. And that gave me a lot of courage to just look at this also as a British political story and to have the courage of my convictions and to think, if the characters of this time appeared on the Today program, what would I ask them? But then when it comes to the dedication, I have three sons. Mikhail, my husband, and I, we have three sons. And as the book was coming to an end, one of them said to me, Amma, are you going to dedicate it to Baba? I.e., are you going to dedicate it to your husband? And I just went, no. It's being dedicated to my mother, and for reasons I think will become obvious through this conversation, and I think even Mikhail doesn't mind. But I think I do see mine as more than a family story, because I think it is the story of a particular generation, a generation who were young people in their 20s and 30s in 1947, who had lived through the Second World War, who had served in the Second World War, but who in their family's past could even remember the time of the mutiny, what is often called in South Asia the First War of Independence. So just as we grow up with our parents' and grandparents' memories, the same, of course, is true for them. So as I wrote, I thought there's a much longer sweep of history than I imagined when I began. But I also had that awareness that many families lived very similar circumstances. And therefore, although mine is primarily a Muslim family of South Asia, and three of my grandparents left homes behind in what is now India, and for the most part, barely got to see them again, I still think that I wanted the book to appeal across communities. So I worked really hard to sort of think what was happening for families who were crossing the other way. But most importantly, I think I didn't want it to be another partition story. I really thought this narrative that is all about violence at the time and mobs and communal violence, this is true, but I wanted to paint on a much bigger canvas, and that's what it ended up being, even though at times the scale of what I was embarking on really was very daunting. And at one point I was in the British Library looking at prisoner of war, handwritten prisoner of war records of the Indian National Army when they were taken prisoner back from essentially after the fall of Japan. And I looked at them and I thought, you are fascinating and amazing, but you are another story and I can't touch you. And I basically looked at the top one and then gave it back to the librarian and said, for another day, maybe.
And your mother kept the tapes.
My mother kept the tapes. I started off, you know, people look at this now, my two grandmothers, Thyra and Mary, are on the cover, and they look at it and they think, oh, you have these amazing records and archives. And I did have some published material from one grandfather. I had an unpublished memoir from another. My great aunt, aged 102, is still alive and was an incredible source of information about my Catholic grandmother, Mary. But for my for one of the crucial characters, my grandmother Thyra, she had left tapes behind. And my mother had recorded her talking about her life, but forgotten about it completely because the recordings were made in the 90s. And it was only when I started writing, she said, I found these. And all it said on the tape was Amma talking, her mother talking. So it could have been anything. And as I played them, after I bought a tape player for the first time in years and played them, and thought, thank God tape players still exist, otherwise I would have been really stuffed. Then, you know, she was talking about her life before and after independence and during.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mukulika, for chairing this. And it's a great pleasure to be in conversation with Michal. And thanks so much to the LSC team. I think it's one of my favorite parts of being at the LSC is actually the LSC Festival. So dedication, I'd already dedicated a book to my husband. It was my first book. You need to keep your husband on time. the book is about my grandmother, to whom I had also dedicated a book. But actually, my father is the missing link in the connection between me and my grandmother. And although the story is not the story of his generation, obviously that generation is what connects me to what connects my grandmother's generation. This is in many ways a book about women, although it's not necessarily written from a women's perspective, but it is a book about the agency of women and also how do you capture that agency when the records and when history is not always on your side. And the men that are part of the story, when they're not sort of evil characters or when they don't have problematic views, are more quiet presences. They're hesitant and they have political dilemmas and moral dilemmas. They try to do the right thing, but they're sort of crushed by historical events. And as I said, my father is not at all in the book because the events finish when he's 1-2 years old. But he was also very much in keeping with this profile of men, because my grandfather, who is a character, was very much like him. And he had also this rather skeptical attitude. You know, he was a man of thought rather than action. And this is a lot a book about the limits of thought in times of crisis, where you have to jump one way or another. And so it's dedicated to my father because he was a lot on my mind. As I say, although I identified with the women in the story, there was something about the way he approached the world and a world that was increasingly not the world that he would have liked it to be, and this divorce between how it should be and how it actually is, and the troubles that this generated, and the anxiety and the emotional difficulty of confronting that was very much on my mind as I was writing this book, which is about tragic events that repeat themselves and about what does an intellectual, what does someone who is in education or in information, in reporting, how does one handle all this complexity and all these tragedies that we're constantly confronted that ask you to take sides, and yet your instinct is always to think on the one hand this, on the other hand this, and preserve the nuance and to say, well, it's not black and white and let's look at where things are coming from. And somehow this particular moment that we live in and the particular times that my book describes were exactly the kind of moments where this intellectual attitude can be paralyzing. And in the meantime, as you work out on the one hand this, on the other hand that, then the world is in the hands of really terrible people and terrible things happen and keep accumulating because of this. And so somehow I was in this quiet conversation with my father as I was writing the book, and that's probably why it felt natural.
And actually, your mention of female agency makes me think about how that is also a thread in my story of South Asian families in the 20th century. You know, rising female empowerment is a part of that. And Muslim families at the early part of the 20th century are starting to send their daughters out to school. And my grandmother's generation is the first who benefit from that. And in Aligarh near Delhi, which is, I'm sure, a place my grandmother witnessed, the educators going out into the tiny alleys of the city and saying to the families, you can trust us with your daughters. We will pick them up at the start of the day and we will bring them back at the end of the day, because families needed that kind of trust to allow their daughters to go out to learn. And so that's also, there's a social history to the events we're describing that I think is also really, really important and is part of the story of the 20th century.
Yeah, and that's what one takes away, really. Even if you're not interested in Albania or South Asia, there is a huge historical story being told, but it's told, you engage with it because of the individual lives in it. But both your titles, one is called Broken Threads, another one's called Indignity. And yet both books are really about hope and love. There's a lot of love in yours, Michal, between your grandparents and how they get together and overcome impossible challenges, really, it seems like it. And Leah, you think about this very deeply in your book in particular, because your grandmother, and they're both Muslim grandmothers here, right? Which is, again, you wouldn't think that, but These are two ends of or two bits, different bits of the Muslim world. They come together a little bit with the Khilafat movement.
Yes, that
right?
is.
With the Ottoman Empire. When the Caliph is displaced, there is a huge movement of Hindu and Muslim unity, a political movement against it in South Asia. And the British didn't like it. The British are very present. It's a very British story, like you say. So do you both want to talk a little bit about writing about hope, but your books being titled Indignity and Broken Threads? Why not? You said they may be frayed, not broken.
Yeah.
You really write about dignity, Leah. But you've called your book Indignity. Do you want to think about that? Do you want to go first?
Yeah. So, in fact, the book, a lot of the book is about dignity. But it discusses, it's a sort of philosophical approach that raises the question of what is dignity in the person, in society, what are the different theories, different philosophical approaches that we have to the question of dignity, you know, from the Stoics to the postmodernists and everything in between. But really the core idea is that dignity is connected to moral responsibility, and it's not something that you see. It's not an empirical quality. It's not something that you can smell and you can touch and you can see it in the world. And in fact, it's this immaterial quality that we all carry just because of the kinds of beings that we are, and that is part of humanity, that we have this reflexive capacity to make moral decisions and to, even when we do the wrong thing, to know that we have done the wrong thing and that we could have done the right thing. And so in many ways, the book, the word dignity keeps coming back and is always mentioned, but only as a word, because in the end it's an aspiration and it's not something that you necessarily see empirically. And what you actually do see is indignity. And the word indignity is never mentioned in the book.
No.
It's only mentioned once in the title and one other time in the very final sentence, which says that it's indignity defied with imagination. And this takes us to the question of hope, because the idea is that in reflecting about the past in a certain way and in telling stories that show us how history repeats itself, but it doesn't have to repeat itself in exactly the same way if we remind ourselves what dignity is. That's where we generate hope in this creative act, in this way of engaging with the past that both shows us the tragedies that have marked these lives and how they were ruined by this indignity of the 20th century, but recover a kind of hope in thinking that the indignity of the 20th century, even though we see many of its features repeated in 2026, so in the 21st century, it doesn't have to be exactly the same thing if we remember that resistance is grounded on this thought about dignity and what humans are and what they owe each other, and that we are all capable of that regardless of where we come from, which identities, which cultures, which religions. And in that sense, I'd say that the final sentence where I say it's indignity defied through the imagination, that is where hope rests, in this act of engaging with the past and in writing about the past that tries to be generative about how we approach the future.
Can I just, Michelle, before you answer my question, there's this wonderful sentence, an animal, which you're quoting Schiller here, right? Who was your grandmother's favorite poet, and so much of your own thought about dignity seems to flow and proceed from there. An animal cannot do anything other than free itself from the pain, but a human being can decide to suffer. And it is that agency, that moral purpose. Right?
Exactly, because I think the core of morality is connected to this capacity that we have to not just follow instincts. You know, we are always told we all want to eat and drink and sleep, but actually if you're in a hunger strike, you don't want to eat. You want to resist the urge to eat because you have a cause, because you have decided to commit yourself that is higher than just this satisfying these base instincts. And not to say that's not important, but it's to remind us about what it is that defines the human, which is this ability to step out of these immediate urges and passions and inclinations. And that's also really important when you think about politics, because often when we're thinking about change in politics and revolutions or feasibility, you will be told, oh, but human beings will never be like that.
Yeah.
And there's this argument about what is human nature that blocks any proposals to change, because you're constantly saying, we will never change, this is what we are, we follow these instincts and we have these passions and we're self-interested. Mm-hmm. And actually this connection between dignity and moral responsibility is helpful to remind readers and the public that that's not the case, and that in fact there's another way of thinking about human nature that is not just that we're selfish and that we're inclined to destroy each other and to destroy the environment and to destroy future generations, but that there is another way of looking at the human.
Yes, indeed.
I love the way the deep knowledge of your professional life is there in your in both your books, but I also love the way you write actually very informally, which makes it, you know, incredibly accessible to someone who's, you know, it's a very accessible book that way. Fez Ahmed Fez, the poet, is right at the start of mine. The poem that he wrote in August 1947, Yedar Dar Ujala, is how it begins. Some of you will understand the stained daybreak. And there are times when I've thought that the title is too negative. Mm. I feel like, you know, there is obviously, it has those connotations of fracturing. And that did come from the fact that early on, one of the, what I heard my grandmother Tahira say on one of those tapes is, people of my generation were not really complete for a long time afterwards. She meant not complete after 1947, that, you know, the fabric of their lives had been torn apart. I think that was true of people whether or not they left homes on the other side of the border. My grandfather Mumtaz, who was from Multan in the south of Punjab, was the only one who was born on territory that became Pakistan. And so, you know, he did not lose his ancestral home. But even so, he felt when independence happened, it meant this entire vast expanse of India where he had served, because he was an army medic, he had served right across the country. He'd seen incredibly different parts of South Asia, completely alien to where he had grown up in. And so he felt absolutely heartbroken that these places that I'd known as part of my service life, as he put it, you know, I was never to see them again. And did you read your own audiobook?
Yeah. I did some parts of it. It has two narrative voices, so I read the first person ones, but
okay,
not the third person.
That's a smart
ones.
Way to do it, because when I got to the end of mine, I did find it an emotional experience to read the book, and, you know, especially right at the end. And some of that is because of the present day. I am the only member of my family, my extended family, who has been able to travel to both India and Pakistan to the extent that I do. And that's not because most people don't have British passports, because even with a British passport, once you tick the box saying, you know, my family migrated in 1947, we're talking, you know, these are the decisions of my grandparents. You know, visas, it becomes difficult. And I feel incredibly fortunate to have traveled in India to the extent I have because of work. And that, and I think somewhere along the line, I just have this real desire that even though I feel so much of my heritage lies on this other side of the border and it's been inaccessible to almost all my family and to me only accessible to a certain extent, but I just thought, I'm not going to let anyone take it away from me. I'm going to reclaim it in any way that works. You know, by going, most people writing a book like that, it would be a travelogue. But when I started writing, it was COVID, and even when I did travel, you know, visas and all the rest. So some of it is a journey of the mind. But I thought, in whatever way I can make it work, I'm not going to let this horrible continuing relationship between India and Pakistan tear me away from something that I feel, you know, is belongs to me. And even now, you know, when I see white British colleagues going to places like the Jaipur Literary Festival and posting their pictures, there's part of me which really breaks inside, because I think, how can they, who have no connection to these, how can they travel so easily? Yeah. And for it to be so difficult for me and people like me. So it does feel like there is a sort of ongoing, I mean, imagine like people of Germany and France and this country never being able to discover, never to be able to go as tourists, you know, decades after the Second World War. So that is an ongoing reality to South Asians. Somewhere I wanted to find my own way of bridging that divide.
And you do it very effectively. Just as a footnote, I had to sit outside the Pakistan High Commission in Delhi on dharna for 2 days before they allowed me to go and meet the High Commissioner. And, you know, there was no reason. If you're not Muslim, and you don't have family, why would you want to go to Pakistan? No, I want to meet old revolutionaries from the freedom movement. Oh, that's not a good enough reason. So I was quite envious for at least the two of you had this deeply personal connection. But the archives, Leah, I mean, you were all over the Mediterranean looking for these sources. And it's forensic work, right? So do you want to talk about that process? How many years did this last? And where were your leads coming from? Were students on the job? What was happening?
Yeah, so the initial lead was this photo of my grandmother that showed up on this Facebook post of someone I had never met before and that started being trolled because of allegations that my grandmother was a spy, and some people said she was a communist spy, some people said she was a fascist spy. It was all connected in part to the reception of my previous book, Free, which was very polarizing in Albania, and so my grandmother had been connected to me, but then it wasn't just me who was being trolled, it was also her. And because it was a photo of her I'd never seen before, and it was a photo of her honeymoon in the Italian Dolomites in the winter of 1941, which she always described as the best time of her life, and I'd always wondered what sort of person can say that this is the best time of her life in the winter of 1941. And so there's all these kind of mysteries around her youth coupled with these allegations on Facebook that set me on this journey to find the original of this photo, which I'd never seen before, which on further investigations turned out to be in the Secret Service archive of former Secret Service archive of communist Albania, which is now a place, as in many other post-communist countries, where you just file an application and make a request to see any document that they have about anyone who might have been in contact with Secret Services, communist Secret Services. So that was the first archive where I wanted to read the surveillance reports by communist spies on my grandmother, with the idea that I would recover the truth of her life based on what these spies were writing about her, which turned out to be a very naive, although it's a very widespread approach in post-communist societies, because we have this idea that you go to the archive and you find the truth about the person that you wanted to investigate. And then it turns out that you can only trust the truth if you can trust the mechanism through which the truth is transmitted. But these archives, they are written by humans for a particular perspective. There's always an ideology that shapes what facts they select and how they write about the person and what they exclude, what they include. In the end, the whole research in Albania led to many kinds of dead ends, including the fact that at some point there was a document that showed that my grandmother was dead in 1953. And since I was born in 1979, it was not possible that my grandmother was, and I lived with her and I grew up with her and remember her. There was some sort of weird Kafkian experience of just finding this grandmother that was dead long before I was born, even though I had met her.
But don't tell them the twist.
No, but all this is to explain the connection between these different archives. So at first I thought, okay, well, this is a communist archive, so ideology, people make mistakes. And then I thought, okay, well, she was born in Greece, in Salonika, when the Ottoman Empire was still around, so I'll go and find the archives in Greece. And then you go to Greece and you say, I want to research the Ottoman Empire, and they say, no, but for that you have to go to, you know, the Istanbul, or because this is the Greek state and we don't have empire archives, we have the Greek. And so unless she was Greek, you can't find anything. Then you go to Italy, where again this photo was taken in Cortina d'Ampezzo, and I'd say, I'm researching my grandmother, and they'd say, no, but the women, there's no chance you'll find anything about women in archives, because it's, if you want to research the husband or the uncle or the grandfather or whatever, then fine, but otherwise good luck. So it turns out that actually for all these different reasons, all these archives are constructed from a particular point of view, which is usually the point of view of the ideological stance that the process of collecting information serves one way or another, whether it's patriarchy or whether it's communism or whether it's fascism or whether it's nationalism or all these different archives. So in the end, I lost my faith in the archive because I had gone to the archive to find the truth, and what I was finding was always a creation of some institution or other. And so then I thought, well, actually, I want to write something also about what the archive is not telling me. So all the silences of the archive and the reasons for why it's not telling me something about this woman or about this person who was born in the Ottoman Empire. And the way to do that was literature. So going to this more fictionalized account and using the imagination to try and reconstruct the world that was lost in the archives or the people that were lost in the archives, because you only have this fragmentary information. And so in the end, the book is a hybrid, which is supposed to reflect on these silences of the archive, where you start with this idea that historical records give you the truth, but actually what they give you is the creation of a power structure. And then you have this other idea, which is that literature and fiction are lies, but actually their lives with the purpose of reconstructing a truth that is missing in the official ideology. And so I end up with this perspective which says that actually maybe there is a higher truth in art and literature than the truth that you find in documents who you know are in the end discover that they're a lie, and an author that tells you actually I'm lying, but with this purpose, it's different perspective. And so maybe there's more sincerity to that effort.
That's a truth we can get behind.
Can I add a perspective on that, but relating to personal archives, which is when you find stories that don't quite match, and so, you know, people within the family or husbands and wives didn't quite give the same kind of account. So, for example, my grandfather, Shahid, had kept the letters after he wrote to his future father-in-law to ask for my grandmother Tahira's hand in marriage in early 1940. He had kept the, you know, quite politely worded letters back saying, we think this is not quite the right time to get married, and can you delay it? We've just had a death in the family and the heat and all these things. And then from my grandmother Tahira, his future wife's tapes, I found out how, you know, when this request to marry her arrived, the family went ballistic because he was a serving soldier. It was the Second World War. He was about to be sent to Burma or North Africa. And the idea that, you know, you could basically have a daughter married and she could be a widow immediately was just, you know, they thought this was such a wrong request even to receive that does he got no self-awareness that, you know, this is not the thing to ask when you're just about to be sent to the front. So there was two different versions that came through. And then with my other grandparents, Mary and Mumtaz, in my grandfather Mumtaz's unpublished memoir, he wrote of he had been a medical student in Lahore and he had met this young Catholic Anglo-Indian girl from the southeast of India, and they'd fallen in love in Lahore and then decided to get married, and he was going to travel for the first time to meet her family, two nights, three days journey by train. And he wrote of this, you know, lovely welcome he had. And so I asked my great aunt Anne about this because my grandmother Mary was no longer there to ask. And she just said, well, my dear, you know, Mary told us she was going to get married to this man from the Punjab. And we imagined, you know, they'd seen films. So we imagined this great strapping Punjabi or Pathan, tall, fair. They have this whole picture of this sort of amazing film star like person from the northwest of the country who's going to visit them. And she said, and then he arrived and I looked at him and I said to Mary, is this the man? So then, you know, poor Mumtaz, my grandfather, never knew what the family were really thinking as they saw Mary's beloved for the first time. But I love this kind of contrast you get from, because, you know, everyone tells their own version of history.
And also in the family, there is also a myth of the past. And so people that are kind of glorified or people that are, there is always a perception and a reception of ancestors by the other generations, which was for me actually one of the greatest fears that I had when I entered this archive, was that I had all these stories about my grandfather, who I didn't know because he died when I was very little, so I don't remember him, but I had all these stories that he went to prison and he had a lot of dignity and he was tortured but he was still not spying. And then I went to open this Secret Service and I was terrified that what I would find would be the exact opposite of what they told me, because they had said, you know, he was tortured but he didn't make any names. And then I was like, well, what do they know? And that's what he said when he came out. But this was someone who was really traumatized. And I think one of the things that I found in the archives was there are actually very, very few heroes, and that often the hero is what we construct, because we need to construct the hero for our own purposes, not because we need to record these lives accurately, but because we just need to hold on to these exemplars of virtue. And actually, when you read these files, not just about my grandfather, but all other political prisoners, people that were also famous in the history of Albania for being heroic, I mean, women that were now are still celebrated. And you read the files and then you realize, actually, no, everyone has their... If you're under torture, it turns out it's really, really hard to resist.
I think if there is a hero in my book, it's no one in my family. It's a man who's really been forgotten by history. And despite this being a book in which the British authorities and British foreign policy basically come off very badly, I think the hero of my book is the last British Commander-in-Chief of the Indian Army, Claude Auchinleck, because of because of the fact that his authority and his grip over the army meant that at the horrible time of communal violence, the army were always reliable, in contrast to the police. But also more broadly, there was a memo that I found, which he had written in about 1945, as Japan had fallen, and these members of the Indian army who had gone over to the Japanese are being repatriated back to India. And many of his Auchinleck's British officers are saying to him, these men are traitors, they are to be court-martialed, and they are to be treated no differently to any British soldier or officer who joined the Nazis. And Auchinleck writes a long memo back to his officers, which is not meant to go beyond beyond their consumption, but he says it is not the same. These men have grown up knowing that they are inferior to the British in their own country. They grew up knowing that their careers were limited, that their prospect of promotion were limited. They grew up suffering racial injustice. Their wives often suffered racial injustice at the hands of your wives in the officers' mess. So he lays all of this out and says, the men who went to the Japanese only did it at the point that this opportunity presented itself, not for other reasons. In some cases, they might have been tortured. In other cases, the Japanese, you know, not unreasonably said to them, why are you fighting for the British when you're not free at home in your own country? So I thought there was a tremendous sort of vision and foresight. And I discovered when I was writing the book that after the war, Churchill, who had sacked Auchinleck from the North African desert in 1942, only to see Montgomery use his plan for the great victory that then happened at El Alamein a few months later. After the war, Auchinleck did say privately to a young Conservative MP, when asked who the greatest British general of the Second World War was, his answer was Auchinleck. Mm. And I thought, what a tragedy in a country that is supposedly so good with its history, so good at memorializing, that this man has been forgotten. Leave South Asia, just forgotten from the true picture of the Second World War.
And because it's such a personal story, Auchinleck's very personal gestures towards your family and to your grandparents and transporting wife and children and so on. So it's not just grand gestures. Mm-hmm. They're thoughtful, emotional gestures that he's capable of, which again, you know, makes you think, it is about questioning the archive, the audience for which it's written. It's about recovering women's voices, mm-hmm. which are impossible to find and locate in the official archive. But also, as women writers, you're probably more attentive to those dilemmas, those naughty nuances that you dwell on, and you find the moral force to respond in some way that you think is a dignified response. Mm-hmm. It, you know, there's no impartial judgment of that. But your grandmothers are able to withstand separation, uncertainty, a lot of violence that they witness. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that, you know, I hate this, oh, are women writers different kind of thing, but it is interesting what you choose to write about and think about, both of you.
Yes, I mean, I initially wanted to write much more of a female story. I really started off thinking I'll write from the perspective of these two grandmothers, because I thought the Muslim and a Catholic, you know, there's something which is like you can tell a bigger story. And then, unfortunately, I did realize that it was basically both of their husbands who had left the written records I would rely on. So I thought, well, this is not great. But I do remember my grandmother Thyra, because my grandfather was like, you know, spent a lot of his retirement writing. And I do remember her saying, I could write a book, but this house would go to pieces if I disappeared off. And you know, because men have that privilege. So, so I was really grateful when I did, through much more digging around, when I, you know, was able to capture the fragments that were therefore able to paint a bigger story. And then, you know, but I think I did work hard at it right at the beginning of Broken Threads. And, you know, you've written about the sari, and there's a fragment of a sari right at the beginning of Broken Threads, which is, you know, which again, maybe a male writer wouldn't have thought of it in the same way. But when Mikhail and I got married 23 years ago.
Is she right?
Yeah. I was given a gift, which was a shawl, a very plain shawl, but it had this embroidered border, and that was the fragment of a sari that had belonged to one of my great aunts. There's a longer story behind that. But when I was told the full story of that particular sari, I realized that when that particular bit of the family left Lucknow in August 1947 because they were worried about communal violence. Not all of my family were refugees. My grandparents made a choice, but other members of the family did leave their homes out of fear. And this was one section of that. And amongst all the things that they grabbed, because they took a train to Bombay and then a boat to Karachi, amongst all the things they grabbed was this sari, which was essentially an heirloom for a little girl who had lost her mother because it had belonged to her mother. And I thought, how incredible, you know, that this was something that they chose to save. But I think perhaps I just, you know, there was a reason I wanted to dig in and think about that story. And perhaps, you know, if my brother was writing this book, he might not have done that.
Yeah, I think for me as well, I didn't set out to write from a women's perspective about women, actually. And I've always been somehow hostile to this idea that only women can write about women and black people can write about black people. And I thought there's something great about the 19th century novel, which is that you have this universal narrative voice that tries to inhabit all these different characters and take the perspective of the different characters, and then you have dialogue and plot, and then let the reader engage in this conversation where you have a complexity and a kind of plurality of standpoints. And part of the fun of writing the book in this fictionalized way is that it enabled me to, you know, write a character who is a Nazi, and to write a convincing character who is a Nazi, you have to think like a Nazi. And so you have to identify even with standpoints that are completely at odds with everything you think and you've believed and you stand for. But on the other hand, I also realized that there are perspectives that are just missing in official stories. Yes. And so that's where I almost stumbled on the kind of female gaze in a way. It's not that I wanted to write about women from a women's perspective. But as I was reconstructing, say, when my grandmother was pregnant, my father was born in 1943, which is the year of the Nazi invasion of Albania, and in exactly the same time. So I was looking at the official historical records. August 1943, you have, you know, mess in Italy and Albania. Suddenly the Nazis enter Tirana. And I knew that my father was born in August 1943. And so I have been pregnant 3 times. And I know what it's like to be pregnant and to give birth. And what you think about when there is a war outside the window, there is also war in the woman body. And you're kind of thinking about, how do I breastfeed? Can I keep this person alive? What is this responsibility that suddenly descended on me? And it's literally a kind of domestic war that is not really written about. No. Was certainly not in the archives about my grandmother that the communists wrote, or the nationalists wrote, or the, you know, the Italians wrote. But there is a perspective there that, you know, must have been the case if she was going through this transformative experience of just discovering what happens, childbirth, and then immediately after. And that's where I felt that if you want to complete the record or to complement this official truth, you can only use the imagination and this identification with people who have gone through similar processes to you to just give another perspective from the one that is captured in the records. So it's not that I set out to recover the female point of view. I just felt that suddenly the official record wasn't giving me any evidence. If I wanted to write about, you know, the songs that my grandmother would sing me when I was little, they were gone. They weren't in any official documents. They were only in my mind and in my memories and in these dreams that I had about her. And to write them, you have to use, again, imagination, identification, and it's a completely different way of writing. And I thought that actually, it's not that I'm writing the truth from a perspective, I'm just trying to give a more comprehensive account of the truth by embodying more perspectives than the ones that are out there.
When 1947 happened, my grandmother, when she reflected on it later, she said, because there were many, you know, in some Muslim communities or in rural areas or wherever, or more conservative families, and women weren't really out of parda at the time that independence happened, and, you know, there were all kinds of, where she said, had to fend for themselves, and how much more difficult it was if you were a woman who had not been out in the world, and suddenly all the structures that have surrounded you have suddenly gone because of the insecurity, and you are really, you know, out there facing the world in a way for which you're completely unprepared.
There's a lot more to say. As you can see, there's a conversation just getting started. I was hoping to talk about the present and the normalization of Islamophobia, which we are all living with, and your books give us a way to think about it. But I'm not going to push you to answer those questions. I hope some of you will, because I do want to take some questions from the audience. We have a few minutes. While you're thinking of your questions, can I shout out to Mikal, Michelle's husband, who's here, who's an LSE alumnus, right? So thank you for coming. I may have had something to do with his presence here. Michelle didn't know. Let's take your question. I'll take two or three questions.
Firstly, thank you so much for the talk. It was amazing. I'd like to ask a question related to the last point on Islamophobia. I know we spoke a lot about cyclical history and history repeating itself, sort of allowing for the suppression of pluralism and ideas. Having wrote about that and visualised that in your books, what advice would you give to modern policymakers to deal with times of such authoritarian growth?
Thank you. Michelle, do you want to just take those
two? I think that, I mean, I like to think that in, you know, even in this incredibly contentious climate, that there is, it's a shame to have to say it, but there is a basic level of, you know, connecting with people as human beings that comes across, I think, in both of our work. So I've absolutely embraced, like, you know, where I describe faith or culture in as it comes up. But I really hope that actually people who are not familiar with Muslim families or Pakistan or South Asia or Islam in any way might read it and just think like they're really quite normal, just like the rest of us. Because, you know, I had at least one of my grandparents, Mumtaz, was incredibly devout. And he began every morning reading from the same copy of the Quran that his parents had given him the day he went away to medical school in 1938, aged 18. And he fasted throughout Ramadan. After my grandmother died, he would fast on the 21st of every month, because that was the day of the month she died. She was a devout Catholic. And I once asked him, how can it be that you two, you know, you both had such a strong faith? I mean, my grandmother dressed my father in blue and white, the Virgin Mary's colours, for 7 years from his birth, because he'd been saved from jaundice. And she was convinced the Virgin had saved him. And my grandfather, who was also a doctor, said, you know, I just kind of knew newborns get jaundice a lot and just recover from it after feeding, but I didn't really have the heart to tell her that, you know, it wasn't necessarily divine intervention. But so, I mean, I'm giving this as an example of just how strong both of them are. And he said, we understood each other perfectly. We both had a strong faith. I would have found it really hard to marry someone who had no faith. So I feel like, you know, there is so much we could take away from their example today. And the other thing I would say is that even the idea of Muslim leaders and what they are, take Jinnah, central figure in my book, the founding father of Pakistan. I think he was not, certainly not a religious leader, but even he was really much more of a role model, as in that he was a professional person at a time when any Muslims who my grandparents knew about were either landed gentry, Nawabs, unique figures like the Aga Khan. These are not role models. You know, this is basically like with everything comes with their birth. So really what they saw in Jinnah was like, we want to be like him. He's a professional lawyer making his way in the British system. His wife is not in Parda. His wife is not a Muslim. Like, you know, there was just a lot of, there was a lot of symbolism of progress. Yeah. That is why he was so important in his lives, not because he was a separatist from day one. He really wasn't that. So I hope that there are more nuanced portraits that emerge that are of relevance in the present day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, same here. Sorry, I missed the first question. I couldn't hear, but I'm actually very excited that I think this must be a historical first where there is an Albanian disrupting an event at the LSE. So it's actually, I'm kind of really excited because people have been so quiet for so many years in Albania. Now they're suddenly gathered all this civic energy, which is amazing to see. But about Muslim, I think my book starts in the Ottoman Empire, but it starts at with the death of a pasha, which is in some ways also representative of the death of the empire, because the Ottoman Empire was called the sick man of Europe, and the book starts with this very undignified death of a pasha who overeats baklava and doesn't end in the way in which his family would like him to end, with this very ridiculous death, and it's supposed to mirror. But the what starts the collapse of the Ottoman Empire is this effort to modernize it, looking to the French. Yes. And in fact, some of the women that I begin the story with, not just my grandmother, but also her aunt, Selma, they start by reading Madame de Stael, and they're in Istanbul and in Salonika, and they speak French to each other. It's a very Francophone society inspired by these models of the French Revolution. These are women who understand that the French Revolution wasn't emancipatory for women, and so they say, well, we take seriously freedom and equality, but we would like that to be extended to women as well. But it starts really with these conflicts that brought down the Ottoman Empire that were the conflicts of a Muslim society. And with these extremely secularized families, as many families, especially of the elites of the aristocracy in the Ottoman Empire, were, also as a way of correcting perceptions about Islam, which shows you that actually the trajectory of modernization and the trajectory of moving away from an authoritarian structure where you rely on religion and tradition and customs to a modernized, commercialized society. That trajectory, that parable of modernity, is actually the same whether you're Catholic or Jewish or Muslim. You just go through these stages. And in fact, if one reads the history of the Ottoman Empire, you discover that for many things, this was a much more tolerant society than not just what we know now and how we imagine Islamic societies. Yep. But even at the time, I mean, one example I always like to give because people are not familiar with is in Victorian England, sodomy was a capital crime. So you could be punished with death. In the Ottoman Empire, you just got fined. And this is a big difference. Mm. And, you know, people would tell you about Islamic societies.
Yep.
But a lot of attitudes and practices, including homosexuality, were much more tolerated in the Ottoman Empire than in surrounding societies around the same time. And that's why I think it's this historical literary approach is really important because it brings a different perspective. And then hopefully people will begin to correct their misapprehensions.
And also there's something in that we should, you know, societies evolve and progress and communities. And, you know, the minute you pigeonhole, you're basically placing people in aspic and sort of saying, because you dress like that, therefore, you know, you are backward, or there are all these other views that we are going to assume you hold. And you know, in Broken Threads, Ross Masood, who's the leader of Aligarh Muslim University, is horrified at the time where Ataturk, they see these pictures from Turkey after the Ottoman Empire collapses, and men and women are dancing together in public, and they're absolutely horrified in India. Like, how could this be happening? And then, you know, equally, in not long after that, he addresses a big gathering of Indian Muslims, and he says, our wives and our sisters and our daughters will not be comfortable and not be willing to remain in parda. And all of you have to see the writing on the wall that these days are over, and either we get with it or basically the women are going to rise up. So, you know, I just think the nuances are there and they're so important then and now.
Yeah. Louise's question online. We have a big
yes, a question online. It starts that stories are truly what connect people. People who can use their humanity and empathy to write or share stories are remarkable. Their skills are invaluable for inspiring and driving collective action, which is necessary for us to save the planet. How would you propose that we educate people, especially children, who are still forming their mental models for how the world works?
You've done the audio.
You're a teacher, you know, so I think you can
start. I'm a teacher, but I'm also a mother. And the two things, I practice what I don't necessarily preach, and the other way around. So I feel that the perspective of the parent, at least the one that I aspire to, even though it's really, really hard, it's to actually encourage critical thinking, and so not to teach in a paternalistic way. And I try to do that with my teaching, and I try to do that with my children. But actually, as a parent, it's much, much harder than as a teacher, because the responsibilities that you have, including for things like safety of children, and that pushes you in a more paternalistic direction that I would like. I think I also lived in a different society, in a different context. I was let very free to explore a lot of things. And sometimes I lament the fact that my children, just because of the kind of world in which they're growing up, it's not possible to give them the freedom to explore and to make mistakes and to do the kinds of things that I had, because you have to look after them and you have responsibilities to protect them that somehow are in contrast with what is possible to do to encourage this critical thinking. And I find that really, really hard, and in many ways heartbreaking, because I think children really grow by just playing on the streets and exploring and getting bored and not, you know, having to monitor and police everything and every aspect of their lives. But in the kind of society where we live, that's somehow really difficult to do. And instead, we have to just micromanage their lives, which is so hard. And
When I was growing up in the UAE, we were, the minute it got cool enough at sort of 4 o'clock in the afternoon, we were sent outside and we weren't allowed to come back to the house until dusk. So it was that safe. And I also think, like, beyond education, it's also the opportunities for contact. And I think in London and in the UK generally, more broadly, we are so lucky in that our children do live in often, or hopefully almost always, in communities where they are going to encounter people from very different backgrounds. And that, when our children went to school with Jewish children, it's like it was so nice to feel like there are other communities who wouldn't eat certain things, or had a day off when no one else did, and all this kind of, like, there's a togetherness in that, but also just to have those basic, experiences where you realize you all play in the same way and you all grieve in the same way.
I think you've both done audiobooks, as you mentioned, Michelle. Maybe doing a children's book might, just pointing out bits of history that never feature, that Albania was the one European country that had a bigger Jewish population at the end of the Second World War than before, right? And you say this in the book. Just actually educating children about history in the round is what we need. The fact that, you write this book, but you humanize these stories and they make them real people. They're not the Muslim community. These are real people with real stories. This, and the British Empire, for goodness sake, we all have to teach students at LSE and all British universities, never having been taught about the history of the empire as part of British history. And it's, at the end of the day, it's these stories of the past that we need for the new generation. I'm really sorry. I know you both have...
I do have a children's book coming next year. Excellent. I'm going to say that. But Fantastic. It's not history. It's basically debating and access to information.
Terrific.
But I think, Leah, we do need the children's version of yours.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, so we have an outcome. An action point. Sorry, that's the word.
I was just going to say, I think just as important and as writing about history is writing about history from different perspectives.
Absolutely,
Because there is a lot of rethinking about the empire, I guess, in schools, but whether you're doing it from one perspective or whether you're doing it from multiple perspectives makes a huge difference to how history is received.
Yeah, Michelle should be writing. Yeah, that she'll get the perspective right. Thank you all so much for coming. There is going to be a book signing, so both authors will be there signing books. Don't engage them in conversation too much, please, because the queue just gets longer, and because it's a drinks reception. So thank you all. Thank you to Leah.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.